Welcome to Dead Writer Drama, where we talk about the professional feuds, sex scandals, messy public breakups, and controversial legacies of history's literary legends. Brought to you by the American Writers Museum.
Hi, I'm Zakiya Zalila Harris, author of the New York Times bestselling novel, The Other Black Girl.
And I'm Jennifer Cation Armstrong. I've written 7 books about pop culture history, including the New York Times bestseller Seinfeldia and When Women Invented Television. The New York Times, January 28, 1922. Nellie Bly, journalist, dies of pneumonia. Mrs. Elizabeth Cochran Seaman, known to thousands of people throughout the world as Nellie Bly, her nom de plume, died yesterday morning of pneumonia at the age of 57 in St. Mark's Hospital, to which she was removed a few days ago from her rooms in the Hotel McAlpin. Born at Cochran's Mills, Pennsylvania, a town founded by her father, Judge Cochran, Elizabeth Cochran found herself penniless when still in her teens and began her journalistic career writing for a Pittsburgh paper at $5 a week. Later, she reached a high watermark of $25,000 earned with her pen in 1 year.
She went down into the sea in a diving bell and up in the air in a balloon and lived in an insane asylum as a patient. But the feat that made her famous was her trip around the world in 1889. She was sent by the world to beat the mark of Phileas Fogg, Jules Verne's hero of Around the World in 80 Days, and she succeeded, making the tour in 72 days, 6 hours, 11 minutes. Everyone who read the newspapers followed her progress, and she landed in New York a national character. In 1895, she married Robert L. Seaman, 40 years her senior, president of the American Steel Barrel Company and the Ironclad Manufacturing Company. They lived happily together at 15 West 37th Street, and on Mr. Seaman's death in 1910, she took entire charge of the properties. Luck turned against her, however, and a series of forgeries by her employees, disputes of various sorts, bankruptcy, and a mass of vexations and costly litigations swallowed up Nellie Bly's fortune. Her courage and liveliness remained, however, and she returned to journalism with all her old spirit. At the time of her death, she was a member of the staff of the New York Evening Journal. Today, we'll be discussing Nellie Bly, who was a journalist, inventor, charity worker, and adventurer who was famous for 2 things. First, her trip around the world in 72 days, an homage to Jules Verne's character Phileas Fogg. And second, for her reporting from within a New York mental institution, which pioneered the practice of undercover investigative journalism. She began her career writing feminist essays for the Pittsburgh Dispatch, arguing that women should be allowed to do more than get married and have children. She eventually transitioned to investigative journalism with a series on women factory workers. After moving to New York City in 1887, she landed an assignment with the New York World that would define her legacy. She would pretend to be mentally ill to gain entry to the Women's Lunatic Asylum on Blackwell's Island to investigate allegations of abusive conditions there.
So, Zakiya, what was your experience of Nellie Bly kind of growing up and hearing about her?
Yeah, I'm a little embarrassed to say I don't remember learning about Nellie Bly. This might be the first time I've really dug into her story, which is part of why I love doing this podcast so much. I feel like I get to learn about so many figures. I will say, though, I did think that I had heard of her earlier because there is, and this is kind of a tangent, but there's this ballad called Frankie and Johnny, which was sung by a lot of different artists, but I know Sam Cooke's version. And it's about this couple where, like, Frankie's partner is cheating on her, and she goes and creeps on him and finds that he's with someone named Nellie Bly. So, so I like went down a rabbit hole last week of like, is this the same Nellie? What a weird, strange thing.
I
guess it was just, and there's no connection, I'm pretty sure. So I know, I was like, did I discover like this crazy tie to Frankie and Johnny? So anyway, that was my first missed connection attempt to meet Nellie Bly. And so this is really my first time. Excited
That's
to chat.
Fascinating. I have to say it could be a journalist thing. Cause like, I don't, you know, this is not like a Frederick Douglass situation or something where it's like, you definitely remember that by in fifth grade you read this, but you know what I mean? It's I necessarily like learned about her in grade school or anything. So it's possible that I just know her as, you know, kind of the history of journalism. And I've learned a little bit about the kind of like stunt girl reporting stuff, right? Which I think is fascinating. And I would love to even like keep reading more now.
Yeah.
Particularly interesting. It's like, it's interesting to me that this was how a lot of women could get into journalism at this time. And I mean, it kind of makes sense in a way, right? Because you couldn't just be a normal reporter. You had to do something extraordinary if you were a woman. And then there's something, I think, a little extra like intriguing slash almost prurient about, you know, oh, she's a girl and she's like doing these kind of dangerous things, right? I don't know.
Yeah.
So weird about it to me.
Well, it's like women spies, right? Like
yeah,
the
totally
idea
women spies.
Going undercover and like, it just seems so, but then it also does seem a little counterintuitive where it's like, it's really dangerous. Like it's so dangerous. And I was listening to a little bit of 10 Days a Mad Woman on audio, which I highly recommend in addition to, of course, Louisa Trega's book, Mad Woman, but it's so risky. And it's wild to me that she was able to do this. and also wilder that the New York Times obituary doesn't really play up that part. They spend more time talking about her like failed end of her life, which is, I think, another really interesting kind of angle that they cover. And of course, this was 100 years ago, so very different climate, but there's so much to unpack there.
She is one of these people where most famous people have like really one interesting part of their lives, right?
Right.
That you make a movie about, and then that's kind of like it. She is so much. I almost wonder if that's part of it too. It's like, you don't know where to look next.
Yeah.
I was sort of fascinated because I, of course, because I come from journalism, like I learned about her mainly because of the journalism stuff, but I didn't even know that she was quote most famous for this 72 days trip business, which is hilarious. Like that's a hilarious stunt to do. Like that's something someone would do now and like put it on TikTok or whatever.
Yes.
It's so, but then she also like marries this much older man and
plot twist.
He's totally loaded. And then she like takes over his business. I don't know. I guess she was just such an adventurous woman and that's all there is to it. She was just free spirited.
Yes.
Spunky.
Spunky really, for sure.
It's really fascinating. I mean, I guess that's why you decide to write a novel about her, but she has so, so much going on and could really be like a multi-season Netflix series of different phases of her life. But to me, the Black Walls Island stuff was the most important and probably, you know, and to me was what I knew. And if you visit Black Walls Island, which is now Roosevelt Island, and it's lovely.
Right.
Like so fun to visit. I totally recommend it to people if you're in New York City. You take the little tram over, which is fun in itself. And the island is like mostly idyllic. Actually, I like did a bike ride around it. It was super cute. But then there's the ruins of the asylums there. And you can just sort of walk through them and they're cool and creepy and like covered in ivy. And they now also have recently they put up a monument to her. At the, what is that, northern end of it, there's
cool.
A lighthouse. Yeah, and you can see it from the FDR if you're just driving by. If you look, you have to know that it's there. But like they have these big sculptures of her face.
Oh wow!
That are these little. It's so cool because you know there's at the other end of the island there's a big monument to Roosevelt. Obviously. Mm-hmm. And this mirrors that actually it has in my opinion, a semi creepy, like it's just like just his, it's almost like a mask of his face. And I think it's kind of creepy. But they do a similar treatment to Nellie Bly on the other side of the island. And I think that's kind of badass just because it like makes her the equivalent of Roosevelt and, you know, the queen of the island. So I think that that's very, very cool.
Yeah, I definitely think Bly Island would be a pretty Blyland. I don't know. I'm getting some like maybe haunted vibes too with the ivy.
Yes, but definitely I like that. I feel like she's big all of that. So she is really important and cool. And I know that a lot of works have been done about her. Like, I don't think she's undercovered, but from what I was just looking at, but it's that feeling of still being like, but there still should be some great big biopic or something, right? I mean, yeah. I don't feel like I've seen like a definitive work about her. So maybe Mad Woman will be it. Maybe it gets the adaptation that we need, because I do think this is still somehow she is, you know, she's known, but I feel like people could know more about her, and your experience verifies that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've asked around to just with other people in my life about it as well. And Nellie Bly did not ring a bell. So okay. I'm really excited to I'm really excited to chat with Louisa today about her process and Nellie Bly and all those really fun details that people who might not know Nellie Bly's life or know about the time she was living would find really fascinating.
Absolutely. So please enjoy our talk with Louisa. Our guest today is author Louisa Traeger, whose forthcoming novel, Mad Woman, tells the exciting story of Bly's risky undercover mission at Blackwell's Island. Traeger, a classical violinist, studied at the Royal College of Music and the Guildhall School of Music and worked as a freelance orchestral player and teacher. She subsequently turned to literature, earning a PhD in English at University College London, where she focused on early 20th century women's writing, and was awarded the West Scholarship and the Rosa Morrison Scholarship for distinguished work in the study of English language and literature. Louisa's first novel, The Lodger, was published by Macmillan in 2014. She lives in London. Hi, Louisa.
Hi.
Welcome to Dead Writer Drama, Louisa Traeger.
Thank you. I'm so thrilled to be here.
So you wrote Mad Woman based on the facts of Nellie Bly's life, but it is a work of fiction. Why did you decide to approach it that way?
Well, I love the form of biographical fiction because it gives me a lot of leeway to explore the character's emotional states. Mm-hmm. And Mad Woman broadly follows the biographical facts of Nellie Bly's life and the history. But you know, just the fictional form gave me a bit more license. And one example of where I used it is that Nellie wrote her own account of being incarcerated in the asylum. And she wrote in this tone of plucky girl reporter whom nothing could faze. And that was obviously what she wanted to put across as an author. But, you know, I thought surely she must have been affected by what she witnessed. She was submerged in this, you know, terribly harsh asylum. She had no definite end date to her ordeal, and she was witnessing this horrific brutality daily. I thought surely it must have had an effect on her physical and mental well-being. And, you know, this was one of the themes that I explored in Mad Woman.
Yeah, we were talking beforehand between ourselves about this kind of idea of this plucky girl reporter thing that kind of became a thing. I mean, it was a trend. Why do you think that these sort of stunt reporters and even this attitude that you're mentioning of having to put forward this plucky kind of persona? Yes. Do you think this was an entry point for women in this way?
Well, the first thing is that when Nellie started off, women weren't taken seriously as journalists. They were confined to writing about fashion, society news, concert reviews, that kind of thing. And Nellie was a pioneer in her field. And I think to be taken seriously, she had to do something so dangerous and so extreme as get locked up, you know, in an asylum. And she pulled it off, you know. Her expose made her a national celebrity, led to, you know, more money being given for the care of the mentally ill. But it also pioneered the era of the stunt girl reporters. And, you know, some of the reporters who followed her did things that were almost as daring. There was one called Annie Laurie who fainted on a pavement and was admitted to a public hospital, and she exposed how badly she was treated there. There was another one who infiltrated a laundry and interviewed the women and exposed how the damp conditions actually gave them terrible lung disease and health problems. So, you know, Nelly sparked this stunt reporter, girl stunt reporter, and I think they couldn't show any vulnerability. And of course, they were also the forerunners of investigative journalists.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's what pulls, I feel like that pulls me and you, Jennifer, and readers to these books of getting to really experience the personal rather than just what the public gets to see. And that's what's so beautiful about your writing. And I just
thank
wanted to,
you.
Of course. And I wanted to kind of ask you a little bit about your process. I mean, your first book, The Lodger, follows H.G. Wells and Dorothy Richardson. Your second book, The Dragon Lady, follows Lady Virginia Courtauld. Can you speak a little bit just about what draws you to your subjects? They're all very different subjects. And you kind of mentioned this a little bit, but how you went about researching Nellie Bly and just your research process in general.
Of course. Well, this, as you said, all my subjects are very different, but there's definitely a theme emerging. And that's the theme of, you know, a woman who was a trailblazer, who was far ahead of her time and who struggled to find her place in the world, actually, and felt very restricted by the narrow conventions, you know, allowed to women in society. So that's the theme. I guess my research process is a little different for all the books, but for Mad Woman, it really began with Blackwell's Island for me, which is now Roosevelt Island. And I really felt that, like Nellie, I had to go there to understand the island and its story. And I walked the island. It's now been gentrified and there are, you know, schools and shops, nice apartments, people going about their lives. I still picked up a sad and eerie atmosphere. That might be my overactive imagination, but I definitely felt something. And I discovered that all that's left of the asylum is the octagonal tower that was like the centerpiece. But, you know, I stood and looked at Manhattan, which was so close, and yet it was unreachable because the East River had these deadly currents and also patrol boats with, you know, eagle-eyed captains. And it just must have been so heart-wrenching for them to be. You can see people, you know, in Manhattan going about their daily lives, but they just couldn't get there.
Yeah, that is. I've been to Roosevelt Island too, and the ruins there are the sort of juxtaposition of the ruins and
the
delightful, like you said, the shops and everything is really striking. And it's a small island, so it's you know it really and it in fact like I can see that island from where I live in Manhattan. So
hey, that's interesting.
Proves your point, you know,
yes.
That I go past it all the time on the ferry boat on the way to the climbing gym in Queens. So it's just very striking because you're right. There's still, I mean, those ruins are still there. There's still a sadness.
Maybe I should just add that in Nellie's day, there was not only an asylum. There was also a smallpox hospital, a workhouse, a prison. And Blackwell's Island was basically the Isle of the Undesirables. It was where, you know, these people were shipped out of sight, out of mind for ordinary, respectable New Yorkers.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's so funny because I live in Brooklyn. I've lived here for 8 years now. And I've been there once to walk around kind of by accident. But when I talk to a lot of other New Yorkers who've lived here for a very long time, most of them haven't been still. And so I can't help but wonder if that legacy of it being this kind of isolated, but still yes. part of the space, but not quite, yes. like if that's passed down.
And not very inviting. That's so interesting. There is one new draw on the island, which I've only seen pictures on the internet, but my next trip to New York, I'm definitely going to see it. There's a monument to Nellie Bly called yes. The Girl Puzzle by the sculptor Amanda Matthews, and it's just incredibly powerful.
Yeah, I was telling Zakia that what I found really striking about it is that it's, you know, the Roosevelt Monument is on one side of the island, and this is on the exact opposite side, and it's kind of similar looking. And so it kind of, it really elevates her to this new yes. level, which is lovely.
Yes, and quite right too.
Yes, absolutely.
She deserves it.
Yes. So going back to your whole kind of process, what were there certain big, I mean, obviously your main focus was the Black Walls Island stuff. Were there big kind of marquee parts of her life that you wanted to hit? And then how did you balance that with, you know, other parts where you were kind of feeling freer to invent your, you know, to do your sort of novelistic stuff?
Yes. Well, where there's less biographical information, that gives me, you know, free range, really, much more freedom. And, you know, where there's a lot of biographical facts, then I did my best to stay true to those. I took a few liberties with the chronology mainly and the characterizations. I mean, for example, my first draft stayed true to all her friends in the asylum, but then my editor said to me, I kept getting them muddled up because they're too samey. So, you know, I focused on one of the real ones and made another friend who was like a composite of the others, and it worked much better. So I guess, you know, I was trying to balance the history with what worked as a novel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yeah. And you alluded to this just now, but were there any particular biographical facts or fictionalized facts that you had in an earlier draft that maybe you and your editor were like, maybe not, that didn't make it in, and why, if you feel comfortable sharing, of course.
Yes, I do. Well, actually, I think it's quite interesting. My first draft started in the asylum with flashbacks to Nellie's earlier life. But my editor said to me her childhood was actually so eventful and so dramatic that she thought I should write it in chronological order. And that worked because I think Nellie's father died when she was young without making a will. So the family weren't provided for. He was a judge, he was quite prosperous, and the family had this huge fall from grace, and, you know, they lost their financial security. And Nellie's mother married a man who turned out to be an abusive alcoholic. And I think that Nellie was a survivor, but it was very tough for her. She had to learn how to get along with things that she didn't have before, and, you know, work and survive in this new, much tougher environment. But I think those years of struggle gave her a huge empathy for the marginalized. And I think they kind of made her what she was. And in the asylum and afterwards, she gave voice to women who had no visibility or status in society. And I think that makes her incredibly topical now, you know, and probably unusual in her time. And that really interested me, how those early years made her what she was. And there were also brushes with mental health in her family. Her mother nearly broke down, you know, when being attacked by the stepfather, and could easily have been incarcerated. And Nelly herself had brushes with insomnia when she was very young. So, you know, that also must have made the asylum much more resonant for her. So I think that really developed while I was writing, as per my editor's suggestion. And I found it very interesting.
Definitely. And I mean, I was struck by, especially, I guess it's just really the first chapter, you have this extremely idyllic picture of her very earliest years before her father's death. And it's like her father is this just like the perfect father figure, right? Kind of ahead of his time and pretty progressive with her and teaching her to read and encouraging her to read and write. And her mother, who told these wonderful, fantastical stories. How do you think that part of her upbringing affected her and kind of maybe even prepared her for this more adventurous life?
Well, her father encouraged her to form her own opinions and not be shy about airing them. And I think that had a huge impact on her. And it also broadened her horizons, because from him, she felt that she could have a career. And her mother was much more conventional and kept saying, you know, women don't have careers, women don't do that kind of work, find a nice husband instead. But she was a storyteller who excelled in telling Native American legends, which I found incredibly powerful. Mm-hmm. And she sort of lit Nelly's imagination. And I think that maybe journalism was the perfect marriage of her father's sort of logical thinking and her mother's storytelling.
That's really lovely. And then they eventually, after the father's death, the family moves kind of to the big city, right? To essentially what is Pittsburgh now. How do you think that changed her life, moving to this more urban area?
Well, first of all, she was very frustrated when she moved there, because her brothers both found fairly decent jobs as clerks. And she, you know, was a housekeeper and nanny. She did domestic work, which was much less well paid than her brother's work and much harder. And so she felt the injustice of that, that there were so few opportunities open for women. And then this extraordinary thing happened. She read an article in the Pittsburgh Dispatch, which really changed her life. It said, its title was "What Girls Are Good For," and it basically said they're good for nothing except, you know, marriage and domesticity. And in China, they kill baby girls or sell them as slaves because they can't find any use for them. And Nelly fired off this response. And I think it was kind of ignited by all the disappointments and struggles she'd endured. And it, you know, it was a blistering riposte. And you can really feel the leap of fury and determination in it. And, you know, it was one of hundreds, but it caught the editor's eye because of the passion with which it was written. And he invited her for an interview, and impressed with her, he offered her a job as a proper reporter, you know, at a salary of $5 a week. And, you know, he gave her her start writing serious articles about factory conditions and the like. But then she put the backs up of advertisers and landlords who didn't want their sort of products and their properties to come under fire. So the Pittsburgh Dispatch put Nelly in this little box where she could only write about, you know, hats and a Vickers butterfly collection. And that in turn propelled her to New York.
I love that. So that really, I mean, that's a huge transition point for her, because that's going to eventually get her to Blackwell's Island.
Yes, exactly. And there was this kind of irrepressible quality to her that I really love. Her maxim was, energy rightly applied and directed can achieve anything. And she really proved that over and over.
I love that so much. I feel like that is definitely the spirit that we have today. I feel like, especially this idea of Nellie Bly, like, clapping back back then. Way that I can't imagine was, I mean, I'm sure it was more common than we know because we don't live in the archives, but it's just so fun to think about. And this also makes me think about the fact that Jennifer and I were talking about this a little bit before. I didn't really learn about Nellie Bly in school. I don't remember learning about her. I didn't study journalism, so that could be why. So I'm really excited that we're chatting about her, and I'm getting so much information about it. And of course, we would recommend Mad Woman to all readers out there, but I can't help but think that like a younger me in college or high school would have really loved to have read something like this back then. And if you were, you know, maybe teaching this in a class or talking to younger people, what would you kind of point at today to be kind of proof of Nellie Bly's legacy, whether it's her kind of can-do attitude or stunt girl reporting? Like, do you see elements of her today?
Yes, I do. So as we've said, her, you know, her actions got better mental health care in her time, and she changed the face of women in journalism. But I think she literally, and in every other way, allowed women to inhabit new spaces. And she gave a voice and a face to women who had no visibility or status in society. And she spoke truth to the authorities, but she also exposed the truth for everyone to see. And I think she left us a kind of guide about how to live, how to help others, how to be open-hearted and non-judgmental. And, you know, to achieving serious, meaningful, compassionate change to unlock injustices. And I think it's, you know, her story is very modern because she was an underprivileged girl. And she became a woman who was so far ahead of her time and who changed the world. And she left it so much better. And I think that, you know, 135 years later, we desperately need Nellie's kind of advocacy. I wish there was a Nellie Bly out there now challenging, you know, politicians and, you know, championing the marginalized. But I guess her legacy and the way we can honor her is by continuing in that spirit, continuing her work of advocacy.
Absolutely. I would love to know what she would think about things today, but
there'd be plenty for her to tackle on both sides of the Atlantic. To think about.
That's lots of letters.
That's for sure. Well, thank you so much. We actually have one more little section of our interview that we like to do. It's just what we call a lightning round, where we actually kind of talk about ways to imagine her in modern times. So with that, Zakiya, you want to start us off?
Sure. Yeah. So kind of going off of our last question, and I'm very excited because I feel like with a person who has taken, you know, Nellie Bly's life and had a lot of fun fictionalizing it, I think you'll be the perfect person to talk to about this. If Nellie Bly were doing stunt girl journalism today, what topics or topic do you think she might be interested in?
Well, maybe she would have infiltrated the government and exposed corruption.
Oof. Which one?
Yes, I know.
Exactly. On the day that Boris Johnson resigns in the UK as prime minister.
So if her life were to be dramatized and you got to pick the medium, which would you choose? A feature film biopic, an HBO miniseries, or an in-depth podcast series?
Oh, I would love a miniseries, actually, because she went on to do so many amazing things. She traveled around the world in, you know, less than 80 days, beating the record of the fictional Phileas Fogg. And she was also the first woman to report from the front in World War One, which is pretty amazing. So I definitely think a mini series.
Different phases of her life. Definitely. Yes. That would be great.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Also just stylistically and visually, it'd be really fun to see the outfits in the.
Yes. Oh, wouldn't it be amazing? How she patched for her world round the world trip she took to dresses.
Yes, that could be three episodes alone. Okay, our next question is, what would Nellie Bly's pandemic project be?
Oh, that's a brilliant, brilliant question. Well, I, you know, she definitely wouldn't have been on the side of the Conservatives and saying liberty. I think she would have wanted to have a lot of restrictions and guard people's health, especially the vulnerable. She was always, you know, very concerned with the vulnerable.
So, I mean, maybe her project would have, maybe she would have been out there. Maybe she would have been out there advocating for that.
She would have been advocating for that. And she probably, you know, she excelled in the personal interviews. So she probably also would have been doing interviews and saying, how has the pandemic been for you? And she would have been extracting the human interest stories while she was lobbying.
Yeah. I love it. I'll be a Zoom. I'm sure.
Yeah, I was going to say her Zoom studio.
Yes.
And our final question is, which, if any, form of social media would she have used? Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok?
Oh my gosh, I think she would have loved Twitter because it's so discursive. I can see her, you know, having long conversations, long Twitter threads. Because not only could she have talked to people and argued, but, you know, she could have like made very visual and verbal points in like long threads. Yes. She would have loved that.
Yes, all the receipts. She'd have all the receipts and the graphs and the links. Right.
That's right. No, she really would, and the polls as well.
I love it. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Is there some place that people can find you and your work online?
I have a website, which is louisatrager.com, and I'm on Twitter quite a lot.
Just like Nellie.
Just like Nellie. It was such a pleasure. You asked such great questions and I had the best time. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you so much.